When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 14 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P.G. Woodhouse. Chapter 14. The Purity of the Turf. After that, life at Twing jogged along pretty peacefully for a bit. Twing is one of those places where there isn't a frightful lot to do, nor any very hectic excitement to look forward to. In fact, the only event of any importance on the horizon, as far as I could ascertain, was the annual village school treat. One simply filled in the time by loafing about the grounds, playing a bit of tennis, and avoiding young Bingo as far as was humanly possible. This last was a very necessary move if you wanted a happy life, for the Cynthia affair had jarred the unfortunate mutt to such an extent that he was always waylaying one and decanting his anguished soul. And when one morning he blew into my bedroom while I was toying with a bit of breakfast, I decided to take a firm line from the start. I could stand having him moaning all over me after dinner, and even after lunch, but at breakfast, no. We Woosters are amiability itself, but there is a limit. "Now look here, old friend," I said. "I know your bally heart is broken and all that, and at some future time I shall be delighted to hear all about it. But I didn't come to talk about that." "No? Good egg." "The past," said young Bingo, "is dead. Let us say no more about it." "Righto." "I have been wounded to the very depths of my soul, but don't speak about it." "I won't." "Ignore it. Forget it." "Absolutely." I hadn't seen him so dashed reasonable for days. "What I came to see you about this morning, Bertie," he said, fishing a sheet of paper out of his pocket, "was to ask you if you would care to come in on another little flutter. If there is one thing we Woosters are simply dripping with, it is sporting blood." I bolted the rest of my sausage and sat up and took notice. "Proceed," I said. "You interest me strangely, old bird." Bingo laid the paper on the bed. "On Monday week," he said, "you may or may not know, the annual village school treat takes place. Lordwick Hammersley lends the hall grounds for the purpose. There will be games, and a conjurer, and coconut shies, and tea in a tent, and also sports." "I know. Cynthia was telling me." Young Bingo winced. "Would you mind not mentioning that name? I am not made of marble." "Sorry." "Well, as I was saying, this jamboree is slated for Monday week. The question is, are we on?" "How do you mean, are we on?" "I am referring to the sports. Steggles did so well out of the sermon handicap that he has decided to make a book on these sports. Punters can be accommodated at anti-post odds or starting price according to their preference. I think we ought to look into it," said young Bingo. I pressed the bell. "I'll consult Jeeves. I don't touch any sporting proposition without his advice." "Jeeves," I said as he drifted in, "rally round."
"Sir?"
"Stand by. We want your advice."
"Very good, sir."
"State your case, Bingo." Bingo stated his case. "What about it, Jeeves?" I said. "Do we go in?" Jeeves pondered to some extent.
"I am inclined to favor the idea, sir."
That was good enough for me. "Right," I said. "Then we will form a syndicate and bust the ring.
I supplied the money, you supplied the brains, and Bingo. What do you supply, Bingo?
If you will carry me and let me settle up later, said young Bingo, I think I can put you in the way of winning a parcel on the mother's sack race.
All right, we will put you down as inside information. Now, what are the events?
Bingo reached for his paper and consulted it.
Girls under 14, 50-yard dash seems to open the proceedings.
Anything to say about that, Jeeves?
No, sir, I have no information.
What's the next?
Boys and girls mixed animal potato race, all ages.
This was a new one to me. I had never heard of it at any of the big meetings.
What's that?
Rather sporting, said young Bingo. The competitors enter in couples, each couple being assigned an animal cry and a potato. For instance, let's suppose that you and Jeeves entered. Jeeves would stand at a fixed point holding a potato. You would have your head in a sack, and you would grope about trying to find Jeeves and making a noise like a cat. Jeeves also making a noise like a cat. Other competitors would be making noises like cows and pigs and dogs and so on, and groping about for their potato holders, who would also be making noises like cows and pigs and dogs and so on. I stopped the poor fish. Jolly if you're fond of animals, I said, but on the whole.
Precisely, sir, said Jeeves. I wouldn't touch it.
Too open, what?
Exactly, sir. Very hard to estimate form.
Carry on, Bingo. Where do we go from there?
Mother's sack race.
Ah, that's better. This is where you know something.
A gift for Mrs. Penworthy, the tobacconist's wife, said Bingo confidently. I was in at her shop yesterday buying cigarettes, and she told me she had won 3 times at fairs in Worcestershire. She only moved to these parts a short time ago, so nobody knows about her. She promised me she would keep herself dark, and I think we could get a good price.
Risk a tenner each way, Jeeves, what?
I think so, sir.
Girls open egg and spoon race, read Bingo.
How about that?
I doubt if it would be worthwhile to invest, sir, said Jeeves. I am told it is a certainty for last year's winner, Sarah Mills, who will doubtless start an odds-on favorite.
Good is she?
They tell me in the village she carries a beautiful egg, sir.
Then there's the obstacle race, said Bingo.
Risky, in my opinion. Like betting on the Grand National.
Father's hat-trimming contest. Another speculative event. That's all except for the choir boy's 100 yards handicap, for a pewter mug presented by the vicar, open to all whose voices have not broken before the second Sunday in Epiphany. Willie Chambers won last year, in a canter receiving 15 yards. This time he will probably be handicapped out of the race. I don't know what to advise.
If I might make a suggestion, sir.
I eyed Jeeves with interest. I don't know that I'd ever seen him look so nearly excited.
You've got something up your sleeve?
I have, sir.
Red hot?
That precisely describes it, sir. I think I may confidently assert that we may have the winner of the choir boy's handicap under this very roof, sir.
Harold the page boy.
Page boy? You mean the tubby little chap in buttons one sees bobbing about here and there?
Why, dash it, Jeeves, nobody has a greater respect for your knowledge of form than I have, but I'm hanged if I can see Harold catching the judge's eye. He's practically circular, and every time I've seen him, he's been leaning up against something half asleep.
He receives 30 yards, sir, and could win from scratch. The boy is a flyer.
How do you know?
Jeeves coughed, and there was a dreamy look in his eye.
I was as much astonished as yourself, sir, when I first became aware of the lad's capabilities. I happened to pursue him one morning with the intention of fetching him a clip on the side of the head.
Great Scott, Jeeves! You?
Yes, sir. The boy is of an outspoken disposition, and had made an opprobrious remark respecting my personal appearance.
What did he say about your appearance?
I have forgotten, sir, said Jeeves with a touch of austerity. But it was opprobrious. I endeavored to correct him, but he outdistanced me by yards and made good his escape.
But I say, Jeeves, this is sensational. And yet, if he's such a sprinter, why hasn't anybody in the village found it out? Surely he plays with the other boys.
No, sir. As his lordship's page boy, Harold does not mix with the village lads.
Bit of a snob, what?
He is somewhat acutely alive to the existence of class distinction, sir.
You're absolutely certain he's such a wonder? Said Bingo. I mean, it wouldn't do to plunge unless you're sure.
If you desire to ascertain the boy's form by personal inspection, sir, it will be a simple matter to arrange a secret trial.
I'm bound to say I should feel easier in my mind, I said.
Then, if I may take a shilling from the money on your dressing-table.
What for?
I propose to bribe the lad to speak slightingly of the second footman's squint, sir. Charles is somewhat sensitive on the point, and should undoubtedly make the lad extend himself. If you will be at the first-floor passage window overlooking the back door in half an hour's time.
I don't know when I've dressed in such a hurry. As a rule, I'm what you might call a slow and careful dresser. I like to linger over the tie and see that the trousers are just so. But this morning I was all worked up. I just shoved on my things anyhow and joined Bingo at the window with a quarter of an hour to spare.
The passage window looked down onto a broad sort of paved courtyard, which ended after about 20 yards in an archway through a high wall. Beyond this archway you got into a strip of the drive, which curved round for another 30 yards or so, till it was lost behind a thick shrubbery. I put myself in the stripling's place and thought what steps I would take with a second footman after me. There was only one thing to do, leg it for the shrubbery and take cover, which meant that at least 50 yards would have to be covered, an excellent test. If good old Harold could fight off the second footman's challenge long enough to allow him to reach the bushes, there wasn't a choir boy in England who could give him 30 yards in the hundred. I waited all of a twitter for what seemed hours, and then suddenly there was a confused noise without, and something round and blue and buttony shot through the back door and buzzed for the archway like a mustang. And about 2 seconds later out came the second footman, going his hardest. There was nothing to it. Absolutely nothing. The field never had a chance. Long before the footman reached the halfway mark, Harold was in the bushes throwing stones. I came away from the window thrilled to the marrow, and when I met Jeeves on the stairs, I was so moved that I nearly grasped his hand. "Jeeves," I said, "no discussion. The Worcester shirt goes on this boy."
"Very good, sir," said Jeeves.
The worst of these country meetings is that you can't plunge as heavily as you would like when you get a good thing, because it alarms the ring. Steggles, though pimpled, was, as I have indicated, no chump, and if I had invested all I wanted to, he would have put two and two together. I managed to get a good solid bet down for the syndicate, however, though it did make him look thoughtful. I heard in the next few days that he had been making searching inquiries in the village concerning Harold, but nobody could tell him anything, and eventually he came to the conclusion, I suppose, that I must be having a long shot on the strength of that 30-yard start. Public opinion wavered between Johnny Good, receiving 10 yards, at 7-2, and Alexander Bartlett, with 6 yards start at 11-4. Willie Chambers, scratch, was offered to the public at 2-1, but found no takers. We were taking no chances on the big event, and directly we got our money on at a nice 112, Harold was put into strict training. It was a wearing business, and I can understand now why most of the big trainers are grim, silent men who look as though they had suffered. The kid wanted constant watching. It was no good talking to him about honor and glory and how proud his mother would be when he wrote and told her he had won a real cup. The moment blighted Harold discovered that training meant knocking off pastry, taking exercise, and keeping away from the cigarettes, he was all against it, and it was only by unceasing vigilance that we managed to keep him in any shape at all. It was the diet that was the stumbling block. As far as exercise went, we could generally arrange for a sharp dash every morning with the assistance of the second footman. It ran into money, of course, but that couldn't be helped. Still, when a kid has simply to wait till the butler's back is turned to have the run of the pantry,
and has only to nip into the smoking room to collect a handful of the best Turkish, training becomes a rocky job. We could only hope that, on the day, his natural stamina would pull him through. And then one evening young Bingo came back from the links with a disturbing story. He had been in the habit of giving Harold mild exercise in the afternoons by taking him out as a caddy. At first he seemed to think it humorous, the poor chump. He bubbled over with merry mirth as he began his tale. "I say, rather funny this afternoon," he said. "You ought to have seen Steggles's face." "Seen Steggles's face? What for?" "When he saw young Harold sprint, I mean." I was filled with a grim foreboding of an awful doom. "Good heavens! You didn't let Harold sprint in front of Steggles?" Young Bingo's jaw dropped. "I never thought of that," he said gloomily. "It wasn't my fault. I was playing around with Steggles, and after we'd finished we went into the clubhouse for a drink, leaving Harold with the clubs outside. In about 5 minutes we came out, and there was the kid on the gravel practicing swings with Steggles's driver and a stone. When he saw us coming, the kid dropped the club and was over the horizon like a streak. Steggles was absolutely dumbfounded, and I must say it was a revelation even to me. The kid certainly gave of his best. Of course, it's a nuisance in a way." "But I don't see, on second thoughts," said Bingo, brightening up, "what it matters. We're on at a good price. We've nothing to lose by the kid's form becoming known. I take it he will start odds on, but that doesn't affect us." I looked at Jeeves. Jeeves looked at me. "It affects us, all right, if he doesn't start at all."
"Precisely, sir."
"What do you mean?" asked Bingo. "If you ask me," I said, "I think Steggles will try to nobble him before the race." "Good Lord, I never thought of that." Bingo blenched. "You don't think he would really do it?"
"I think he would have a jolly good try. Steggles is a bad man.
From now on, Jeeves, we must watch Harold like hawks."
"Undoubtedly, sir."
"Ceaseless vigilance, what?"
"Precisely, sir."
"You wouldn't care to sleep in his room, Jeeves?"
"No, sir, I should not."
"No, nor would I, if it comes to that. But dash it all," I said, "we're letting ourselves get rattled. We're losing our nerve. This won't do. How can Steggles possibly get at Harold, even if he wants to?" There was no cheering young Bingo up. He's one of those birds who simply leap at the morbid view if you give them half a chance. "There are all sorts of ways of nobbling favorites," he said in a sort of deathbed voice. "You ought to read some of these racing novels." In Pipped on the Post, Lord Jasper Mulvere, as near as a toucher, outed Bonnie Betsy by bribing the head lad to slip a cobra into her stable the night before the Derby. "What are the chances of a cobra biting Harold, Jeeves?"
"Slight, I should imagine, sir, and in such an event, knowing the boy as intimately as I do, my anxiety would be entirely for the snake."
"Still, unceasing vigilance, Jeeves."
"Most certainly, sir."
I must say, I got a bit fed with young Bingo in the next few days. It's all very well for a fellow with a big winner in his stable to exercise proper care, but in my opinion, Bingo overdid it. The blighter's mind appeared to be absolutely saturated with racing fiction. And in stories of that kind, as far as I could make out, no horse is ever allowed to start in a race without at least a dozen attempts to put it out of action. He stuck to Harold like a plaster. Never let the unfortunate kid out of his sight. Of course, it meant a lot to the poor old egg if he could collect on this race, because it would give him enough money to chuck his tutoring job and get back to London. But all the same, he needn't have woken me up at 3 in the morning twice running, once to tell me we ought to cook Harold's food ourselves to prevent doping, the other time to say that he had heard mysterious noises in the shrubbery. But he reached the limit, in my opinion, when he insisted on my going to evening service on Sunday, the day before the sports. "Why on earth?" I said, never being much of a lad for evensong. "Well, I can't go myself. I shan't be here. I've got to go to London today with young Egbert."
Egbert was Lord Wick Hammersley's son, the one Bingo was tutoring.
"He's going for a visit down in Kent, and I've got to see him off at Charing Cross. It's an infernal nuisance. I shan't be back till Monday afternoon. In fact, I shall miss most of the sports, I expect. Everything, therefore, depends on you, Bertie."
"But why should either of us go to evening service?"
"Us? Harold sings in the choir, doesn't he?"
"What about it? I can't stop him dislocating his neck over a high note, if that's what you're afraid of."
"Fool, Stego sings in the choir, too. There may be dirty work after the service."
"What absolute rot!"
"Is it?" said young Bingo. "Well, let me tell you that in Jenny the Girl Jockey, the villain kidnapped the boy who was to ride the favorite the night before the big race, and he was the only one who understood and could control the horse. And if the heroine hadn't dressed up in riding things, and—"
"Oh, all right, all right.
But if there's any danger, it seems to me the simplest thing would be for Harold not to turn out on Sunday evening."
"He must turn out. You seem to think the infernal kid is a monument of rectitude, beloved by all. He's got the shakiest reputation of any kid in the village. His name is as near being mud as it can jolly well stick. He's played hooky from choir so often that the vicar told him if one more thing happened, he would fire him out. Nice chumps we should look if he was scratched the night before the race." Well, of course, that being so, there was nothing for it but to toddle along. There's something about evening service in a country church that makes a fellow feel drowsy and peaceful. Sort of end-of-a-perfect-day feeling. Old Heppenstall was up in the pulpit, and he has a kind of regular bleating delivery that assists thought. They had left the door open, and the air was full of a mixed scent of trees and honeysuckle and mildew and villagers' Sunday clothes. As far as the eye could reach, you could see farmers propped up in restful attitudes, breathing heavily. And the children in the congregation, who had fidgeted during the earlier part of the proceedings, were now lying back in a surfeited sort of coma. The last rays of the setting sun shone through the stained-glass windows, birds were twittering in the trees, the women's dresses crackled gently in the stillness. Peaceful. That's what I'm driving at. It felt peaceful. Everybody felt peaceful. And that is why the explosion, when it came, sounded like the end of all things. I call it an explosion, because that was what it seemed like when it broke loose. One moment a dreamy hush was all over the place, broken only by old Heppenstall talking about our duty to our neighbors, and then suddenly a sort of piercing, shrieking squeak that got you right between the eyes and ran all the way down your spine and out at the soles of the feet.
"Ee, ee, 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 ooh, ee, 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 ee."
It sounded like about 600 pigs having their tails twisted simultaneously, but it was simply the kid Harold, who appeared to be having some species of fit. He was jumping up and down and slapping at the back of his neck, and about every other second he would take a deep breath and give out another of the squeals. Well, I mean, you can't do that sort of thing in the middle of the sermon during the evening service without exciting remark. The congregation came out of its trance with a jerk and climbed on the pews to get a better view. Old Heppenstall stopped in the middle of a sentence and spun round, and a couple of vergers with great presence of mind bounded up the aisle like leopards, collected Harold still squealing, and marched him out. They disappeared into the vestry, and I grabbed my hat and legged it round to the stage door, full of apprehension and what not. I couldn't think what the deuce could have happened, but somewhere dimly behind the proceedings there seemed to me to lurk the hand of the blighter Steggles. By the time I got there and managed to get someone to open the door, which was locked, the service seemed to be over. Old Heppenstall was standing in the middle of a crowd of choir boys and vergers and sextons and what not, putting the wretched Harold through it with no little vim. I had come in at the tail end of what must have been a fairly fruity oration.
"Wretched boy! How dare you! I got a sensitive skin. This is no time to talk about your skin. Somebody put a beetle down my back. Absurd! I felt it wriggling. Nonsense!"
"Sounds pretty thin, doesn't it?" said someone at my side. It was Steggles, dash him.
clad in a snowy surplice or cassock or whatever they call it, and wearing an expression of grave concern, the blighter had the cold, cynical crust to look me in the eyeball without a blink. "Did you put a beetle down his neck?" I cried. "Me?" said Steggles. "Me?" Old Heppenstall was putting on the black cap. "I do not credit a word of your story, wretched boy. I have warned you before, and now the time has come to act. You cease from this moment to be a member of my choir. Go, miserable child!" Steggles plucked at my sleeve. "In that case," he said, "those bets, you know, I'm afraid you lose your money, dear old boy. It's a pity you didn't put it on S.P. I always think S.P.'s the only safe way." I gave him one look. Not a bit of good, of course. "And they talk about the purity of the turf," I said, and I meant it to sting, by Jove. Jeeves received the news bravely, but I think the man was a bit rattled beneath the surface.
"An ingenious young gentleman, Mr. Steggles, sir.
A bally swindler, you mean?
Perhaps that would be a more exact description. However, these things will happen on the turf, and it is useless to complain. I wish I had your sunny disposition, Jeeves."
Jeeves bowed.
"We now rely, then, it would seem, sir, almost entirely on Mrs. Penworthy. Should she justify Mr. Little's encomiums and show real class in the mother's sack race, our gains will just balance our losses."
"Yes, but that's not much consolation when you've been looking forward to a big win."
"It is just possible that we may still find ourselves on the right side of the ledger after all, sir. Before Mr. Little left, I persuaded him to invest a small sum for the syndicate of which you were kind enough to make me a member, sir, on the girls' egg and spoon race."
"On Sarah Mills?"
"No, sir. On a long-priced outsider. Little Prudence Baxter, sir, the child of his lordship's head gardener. Her father assures me she has a very steady hand. She is accustomed to bring him his mug of beer from the cottage each afternoon, and he informs me she has never spilled a drop."
"Well, that sounded as though young Prudence's control was good. But how about speed? With seasoned performers like Sarah Mills entered, the thing practically amounted to a classic race, and in these big events you must have speed."
"I am aware that it is what is termed a long shot, sir. Still, I thought it judicious."
"You backed her for a place, too, of course?"
"Yes, sir. Each way."
"Well, I suppose it's all right. I've never known you make a bloomer yet."
"Thank you very much, sir."
I'm bound to say that, as a general rule, my idea of a large afternoon would be to keep as far away from a village school treat as possible. A sticky business. But with such grave issues toward, if you know what I mean, I sank my prejudices on this occasion and rolled up. I found the proceedings about as scaly as I had expected. It was a warm day, and the hall grounds were a dense, practically liquid mass of peasantry. Kids seethed to and fro. One of them, a small girl of sorts, grabbed my hand and hung on to it as I clove my way through the jam to where the mother's sack race was to finish. We hadn't been introduced, but she seemed to think I would do as well as anyone else to talk to about the rag doll she had won in the lucky dip, and she rather spread herself on the topic. "I'm going to call it Gertrude," she said, "and I shall undress it every night and put it to bed, and wake it up in the morning and dress it and put it to bed at night, and wake it up next morning and dress it." "I say, old thing," I said, "I don't want to hurry you and all that, but you couldn't condense it a bit, could you? I'm rather anxious to see the finish of this race. The Wooster fortunes are by way of hanging on it." "I'm going to run in a race soon," she said, shelving the doll for the nonce and descending to ordinary chit-chat.
"Yes," I said, distrait, if you know what I mean, and tried to peer through the chinks in the crowd. "What race is that?"
"Egg and spoon."
"No, really? Are you Sarah Mills?"
"No," registering scorn, "I'm Prudence Baxter."
Naturally, this put our relations on a different footing. I gazed at her with considerable interest. One of the stable. I must say, she didn't look much of a flyer. She was short and round. Bit out of condition, I thought.
"I say," I said, "that being so, you mustn't dash about in the hot sun and take the edge off yourself. You must conserve your energies, old friend. Sit down here in the shade."
"Don't want to sit down."
"Well, take it easy, anyhow."
The kid flitted to another topic like a butterfly hovering from flower to flower.
"I'm a good girl," she said.
"I bet you are. I hope you're a good egg and spoon racer, too."
"Harold's a bad boy. Harold squealed in church and isn't allowed to come to the treat."
"I'm glad," continued this ornament of her sex, wrinkling her nose virtuously,
"because he's a bad boy. He pulled my hair Friday. Harold isn't coming to the treat. Harold isn't coming to the treat. Harold isn't coming to the treat," she chanted, making a regular song of it.
"Don't rub it in, my dear old gardener's daughter," I pleaded. "You don't know it, but you've hit on a rather painful subject."
"Ah, Wooster, my dear fellow, so you have made friends with this little lady?"
It was old Heppenstall, beaming pretty profusely, life and soul of the party.
"I'm delighted, my dear Wooster," he went on, "quite delighted at the way you young men are throwing yourselves into the spirit of this little festivity of ours."
"Oh, yes," I said.
"Oh, yes. Even Rupert Steggles. I must confess that my opinion of Rupert Steggles has materially altered for the better this afternoon."
Mine hadn't, but I didn't say so.
"I have always considered Rupert Steggles, between ourselves, a rather self-centered youth, by no means the kind who would put himself out to further the enjoyment of his fellows. And yet, twice within the last half-hour, I have observed him escorting Mrs. Penworthy, our worthy tobacconist's wife, to the refreshment tent."
I left him standing. I shook off the clutching hand of the Baxter kid and hared it rapidly to the spot where the mother's sack race was just finishing. I had a horrid presentiment that there had been more dirty work at the crossroads. The first person I ran into was young Bingo. I grabbed him by the arm.
"Who won?"
"I don't know. I didn't notice."
There was bitterness in the chappie's voice.
"It wasn't Mrs. Penworthy, Dasher. Bertie, that hound Steggles is nothing more or less than one of our leading snakes.
I don't know how he heard about her, but he must have got onto it that she was dangerous.
Do you know what he did? He lured that miserable woman into the refreshment tent 5 minutes before the race and brought her out so weighed down with cake and tea that she blew up in the first 20 yards. Just rolled over and lay there. Well, thank goodness, we still have Harold."
I gaped at the poor chump.
"Harold, haven't you heard?"
"Heard?"
Bingo turned a delicate green.
"Heard what? I haven't heard anything. I only arrived 5 minutes ago. Came here straight from the station. What has happened? Tell me."
I slipped him the information. He stared at me for a moment in a ghastly sort of way, then, with a hollow groan, tottered away and was lost in the crowd. A nasty knock, poor chap. I didn't blame him for being upset. They were clearing the decks now for the egg and spoon race, and I thought I might as well stay where I was and watch the finish. Not that I had much hope. Young Prudence was a good conversationalist, but she didn't seem to me to be the build for a winner. As far as I could see through the mob, they got off to a good start. A short, red-haired child was making the running with a freckled blonde second, and Sarah Mills lying up in easy third. Our nominee was straggling along with the field, well behind the leaders. It was not hard even as early as this to spot the winner. There was a grace, a practiced precision, in the way Sarah Mills held her spoon that told its own story. She was cutting out a good pace, but her egg didn't even wobble. A natural egg and spooner, if ever there was one. Class will tell. 30 yards from the tape, the red-haired kid tripped over her feet and shot her egg onto the turf. The freckled blonde fought gamely, but she ran herself out halfway down the straight, and Sarah Mills came past and home on a tight rein by several lengths, a popular winner. The blonde was second. A sniffing female in blue gingham beat a pie-faced kid in pink for the place money, and Prudence Baxter, Jeeves's long shot, was either fifth or sixth, I couldn't see which. And then I was carried along with the crowd to where old Heppenstall was going to present the prizes. I found myself standing next to the man Steggles.
"Hello, old chap," he said, very bright and cheery. "You've had a bad day, I'm afraid."
I looked at him with silent scorn, lost on the blighter, of course.
"It's not been a good meeting for any of the big punters," he went on.
"Poor old Bingo Little went down badly over that egg and spoon race."
I hadn't been meaning to chat with the fellow, but I was startled.
"How do you mean badly?" I said.
He only had a small bet on."
"I don't know what you call small. He had 30 quid each way on the Baxter Kid."
The landscape reeled before me.
"What?"
"30 quid at 10 to 1.
I thought he must have heard something, but apparently not.
The race went by the form book, all right."
I was trying to do sums in my head.
I was just in the middle of working out the syndicate's losses when old Heppenstall's voice came sort of faintly to me out of the distance. He had been pretty fatherly and debonair when laying out the prizes for the other events, but now he had suddenly grown all pained and grieved. He peered sorrowfully at the multitude.
"With regard to the girls' egg and spoon race, which has just concluded," he said, "I have a painful duty to perform. Circumstances have arisen which it is impossible to ignore. It is not too much to say that I am stunned."
He gave the populace about 5 seconds to wonder why he was stunned, then went on.
"3 years ago, as you are aware, I was compelled to expunge from the list of events at this annual festival the Father's Quarter Mile, owing to reports coming to my ears of wagers taken and given on the result at the village inn, and a strong suspicion that on at least one occasion the race had actually been sold by the speediest runner. That unfortunate occurrence shook my faith in human nature, I admit. But still, there was one event at least which I confidently expected to remain untainted by the miasma of professionalism. I allude to the girls' egg and spoon race. It seems, alas, that I was too sanguine."
He stopped again and wrestled with his feelings.
"I will not weary you with the unpleasant details. I will merely say that before the race was run, a stranger in our midst, the manservant of one of the guests at the hall, I will not specify with more particularity, approached several of the competitors and presented each of them with 5 shillings on condition that they, finished. A belated sense of remorse has led him to confess to me what he did, but it is too late. The evil is accomplished, and retribution must take its course. It is no time for half measures. I must be firm. I rule that Sarah Mills, Jane Parker, Bessie Clay, and Rosie Jukes, the first 4 to pass the winning post, have forfeited their amateur status and are disqualified. And this handsome workbag, presented by Lord Wickhammersley, goes in consequence to Prudence Baxter. Prudence, step forward."
End of chapter 14. Chapter 15 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P. G. Woodhouse. Chapter 15. The Metropolitan Touch. Nobody is more alive than I am to the fact that young Bingo Little is in many respects a sound old egg. In one way and another, he has made life pretty interesting for me at intervals ever since we were at school. As a companion for a cheery hour, I think I would choose him before anybody. On the other hand, I'm bound to say that there are things about him that could be improved. This habit of falling in love with every second girl he sees is one of them. And another is his way of letting the world in on the secrets of his heart. If you want shrinking reticence, don't go to Bingo, because he's got about as much of it as a soap advertisement. I mean to say, well, here's a telegram I got from him one evening in November, about a month after I'd got back to town from my visit to Twing Hall. "I say, Bertie, old man, I am in love at last. She is the most wonderful girl, Bertie, old man. This is the real thing at last, Bertie. Come here at once and bring Jeeves. Oh, I say, you know that tobacco shop in Bond Street on the left side as you go up?
Will you get me 100 of their special cigarettes and send them to me here? I have run out. I know when you see her, you will think she is the most wonderful girl. Mind you, bring Jeeves. Don't forget the cigarettes. Bingo. It had been handed in at Twing Post Office. In other words, he had submitted that frightful rot to the goggling eye of a village postmistress, who was probably the mainspring of local gossip and would have the place ringing with the news before nightfall. He couldn't have given himself away more completely if he had hired the town crier. When I was a kid, I used to read stories about knights and Vikings and that species of chappie who would get up without a blush in the middle of a crowded banquet and loose off a song about how perfectly priceless they thought their best girl. I've often felt that those days would have suited young Bingo down to the ground. Jeeves had brought the thing in with the evening drink, and I slung it over to him. "It's about due, of course," I said. "Young Bingo hasn't been in love for at least a couple of months. I wonder who it is this time." "Miss Mary Burgess, sir," said Jeeves, "the niece of the Reverend Mr. Heppenstall. She is staying at Twing Vicarage." "Great Scott!" I knew that Jeeves knew practically everything in the world, but this sounded like second sight. "How do you know that?" "When we were visiting Twing Hall in the summer, sir, I formed a somewhat close friendship with Mr. Heppenstall's butler. He is good enough to keep me abreast of the local news from time to time. From his account, sir, the young lady appears to be a very estimable young lady. Of a somewhat serious nature, I understand." "Mr. Little is very épris, sir. Brookfield, my correspondent, writes that last week he observed him in the moonlight, at an advanced hour, gazing up at his window." "Whose window? Brookfield's?" "Yes, sir, presumably under the impression that it was the young lady's." "But what the deuce is he doing at Twing at all?" "Mr. Little was compelled to resume his old position as tutor to Lord Wickhammersley's son at Twing Hall, sir, owing to having been unsuccessful in some speculations at Hurst Park at the end of October." "Good Lord, Jeeves, is there anything you don't know?" "I could not say, sir." I picked up the telegram. "I suppose he wants us to go down and help him out a bit?" "That would appear to be his motive in dispatching the message, sir." "Well, what shall we do? Go?" "I would advocate it, sir. If I may say so, I think that Mr. Little should be encouraged in this particular matter." "You think he's picked a winner this time?" "I hear nothing but excellent reports of the young lady, sir. I think it is beyond question that she would be an admirable influence for Mr. Little should the affair come to a happy conclusion. Such a union would also, I fancy, go far to restore Mr. Little to the good graces of his uncle, the young lady being well-connected and possessing private means. In short, sir, I think that if there is anything we can do, we should do it." "Well, with you behind him," I said, "I don't see how he can fail to click." "You are very good, sir," said Jeeves. "The tribute is much appreciated." Bingo met us at Twing Station next day, and insisted on my sending Jeeves on in the car with the bags while he and I walked. He started in about the female the moment we had begun to hoof it. "She is very wonderful, Bertie. She is not one of those flippant, shallow-minded modern girls. She is sweetly grave and beautifully earnest. She reminds me of—what is the name I want?" "Marie Lloyd?" "Saint Cecilia," said young Bingo, eyeing me with a good deal of loathing. "She reminds me of Saint Cecilia. She makes me yearn to be a better, nobler, deeper, broader man." "What beats me," I said, following up a train of thought, "is what principle you picked them on. The girls you fall in love with, I mean. I mean to say, what's your system? As far as I can see, no two of them are alike. First it was Mabel the waitress, then Honoria Glossop, then that fearful blister Charlotte Corday Robotham." I own that Bingo had the decency to shudder. Thinking of Charlotte always makes me shudder, too. "You don't seriously mean, Bertie, that you are intending to compare the feeling I have for Mary Burgess, the holy devotion, the spiritual—" "Oh, all right, let it go," I said. "I say, old lad, aren't we going rather a long way round?"
Considering that we were supposed to be heading for Twing Hall, it seemed to me that we were making a longish job of it. The hall is about 2 miles from the station by the main road, and we had cut off down a lane, gone across country for a bit, climbed a stile or two, and were now working our way across a field that ended in another lane. "She sometimes takes her little brother for a walk round this way," explained Bingo. "I thought we would meet her and bow, and you could see her, you know, and then we would walk on." "Of course," I said, "that's enough excitement for anyone, and undoubtedly a corking reward for tramping 3 miles out of one's way over ploughed fields with tight boots. But don't we do anything else? Don't we tack on to the girl and buzz along with her?" "Good Lord!" said Bingo, honestly amazed. "You don't suppose I've got nerve enough for that, do you? I just look at her from afar off and all that sort of thing. Quick, here she comes. No, I'm wrong." It was like that song of Harry Lauder's, where he's waiting for the girl and says, "This is her. No, it's a rabbit." Young Bingo made me stand there in the teeth of a northeast half-gale for 10 minutes, keeping me on my toes with a series of false alarms, and I was just thinking of suggesting that we should lay off and give the rest of the proceedings a miss, when round the corner there came a fox terrier, and Bingo quivered like an aspen. Then there hove in sight a small boy, and he shook like a jelly. Finally, like a star whose entrance has been worked up by the personnel of the ensemble, a girl appeared, and his emotion was painful to witness. His face got so red that, what with his white collar and the fact that the wind had turned his nose blue, he looked more like a French flag than anything else. He sagged from the waist upwards as if he had been filleted. He was just raising his fingers limply to his cap when he suddenly saw that the girl wasn't alone. A chappie in clerical costume was also among those present, and the sight of him didn't seem to do Bingo a bit of good. His face got redder and his nose bluer, and it wasn't until they had nearly passed when he managed to get hold of his cap. The girl bowed. The curate said, "Ah, little, rough weather." The dog barked, and then they toddled on, and the entertainment was over. The curate was a new factor in the situation to me. I reported his movements to Jeeves when I got to the hall. Of course, Jeeves knew all about it already. "That is the Reverend Mr. Wingham, Mr. Heppenstall's new curate, sir. I gather from Brookfield that he is Mr. Little's rival, and at the moment the young lady appears to favor him. Mr. Wingham has the advantage of being on the premises. He and the young lady play duets after dinner, which acts as a bond. Mr. Little, on these occasions, I understand, prowls about in the road, chafing visibly." "That seems to be all the poor fish is able to do, dash it. He can chafe all right, but there he stops. He's lost his pep. He's got no dash. Why, when we met her just now, he hadn't even the common manly courage to say good evening." "I gather that Mr. Little's affection is not unmingled with awe, sir." "Well, how are we to help a man when he's such a rabbit as that? Have you anything to suggest? I shall be seeing him after dinner, and he's sure to ask first thing what you advise." "In my opinion, sir, the most judicious course for Mr. Little to pursue would be to concentrate on the young gentleman." "The small brother? How do you mean?" "Make a friend of him, sir. Take him for walks and so forth." "It doesn't sound like one of your red-hottest ideas. I must say, I expected something fruitier than that." "It would be a beginning, sir, and might lead to better things." "Well, I'll tell him. I like the look of her, Jeeves." "A thoroughly estimable young lady, sir." I slipped Bingo the tip from the stable that night, and was glad to observe that it seemed to cheer him up. "Jeeves is always right," he said. "I ought to have thought of it myself. I'll start in tomorrow." It was amazing how the chappie bucked up. Long before I left for town, it had become a mere commonplace for him to speak to the girl. I mean, he didn't simply look stuffed when they met. The brother was forming a bond that was a dash sight stronger than the curate's duets. She and Bingo used to take him for walks together. I asked Bingo what they talked about on these occasions, and he said Wilfred's future. The girl hoped that Wilfred would one day become a curate, but Bingo said no,
There was something about curates he didn't quite like. The day we left, Bingo came to see us off with Wilfred frisking about him like an old college chum. The last I saw of them, Bingo was standing him chocolates out of the slot machine. A scene of peace and cheery goodwill. Dashed promising, I thought. Which made it all the more of a jar about a fortnight later, when his telegram arrived. As follows. "Bertie, old man, I say, Bertie, could you possibly come down here at once? Everything gone wrong, hang it all. Dash it, Bertie, you simply must come. I am in a state of absolute despair and heartbroken. Would you mind sending another 100 of those cigarettes? Bring Jeeves when you come, Bertie. You simply must come, Bertie. I rely on you. Don't forget to bring Jeeves. Bingo." For a chap who's perpetually hard up, I must say that young Bingo is the most wasteful telegraphist I ever struck. He's got no notion of condensing. The silly ass simply pours out his wounded soul at twopence a word, or whatever it is, without a thought. "How about it, Jeeves?" I said. "I'm getting a bit fed up. I can't go chucking all my engagements every second week in order to biff down to Twing and rally round young Bingo. Send him a wire telling him to end it all in the village pond." "If you could spare me for the night, sir, I should be glad to run down and investigate." "Oh, dash it! Well, I suppose there's nothing else to be done. After all, you're the fellow he wants. All right, carry on." Jeeves got back late the next day. "Well?" I said. Jeeves appeared perturbed. He allowed his left eyebrow to flicker upwards in a concerned sort of manner. "I have done what I could, sir," he said, "but I fear Mr. Little's chances do not appear bright. Since our last visit, sir, there has been a decidedly sinister and disquieting development." "Oh, what's that?" "You may remember Mr. Steggles, sir, the young gentleman who was studying for an examination with Mr. Heppenstall at the vicarage." "What's Steggles got to do with it?" I asked. "I gather from Brookfield, sir, who chanced to overhear a conversation, that Mr. Steggles is interesting himself in the affair." "Good Lord! What, making a book on it?" "I understand that he's accepting wages from those in his immediate circle, sir, against Mr. Little, whose chances he does not seem to fancy." "I don't like that, Jeeves." "No, sir, it is sinister." "From what I know of Steggles, there will be dirty work." "It has already occurred, sir." "Already?" "Yes, sir. It seems that, in pursuance of the policy which he had been good enough to allow me to suggest to him, Mr. Little escorted Master Burgess to the church bazaar, and there met Mr. Steggles, who is in the company of young Master Heppenstall, the Reverend Mr. Heppenstall's second son, who is home from Rugby just now, having recently recovered from an attack of mumps. The encounter took place in the refreshment room, where Mr. Steggles was at that moment entertaining Master Heppenstall. To cut a long story short, sir, the two gentlemen became extremely interested in the haughty manner in which the lads were fortifying themselves. And Mr. Steggles offered to back his nominee in a weight-for-age eating contest against Master Burgess for a pound a side. Mr. Little admitted to me that he was conscious of a certain hesitation as to what the upshot might be should Miss Burgess get to hear of the matter, but his sporting blood was too much for him, and he agreed to the contest. This was duly carried out, both lads exhibiting the utmost willingness and enthusiasm, and eventually Master Burgess justified Mr. Little's confidence by winning, but only after a bitter struggle. Next day both contestants were in considerable pain. Inquiries were made and confessions extorted, and Mr. Little, I learned from Brookfield, who happened to be near the door of the drawing-room at the moment, had an extremely unpleasant interview with the young lady, which ended in her desiring him never to speak to her again. There's no getting away from the fact that, if ever a man required watching, it's Steggles. Machiavelli could have taken his correspondence course. "It was a put-up job, Jeeves," I said. "I mean, Steggles worked the whole thing on purpose. It's his old nobbling game."
"There would seem to be no doubt about that, sir."
"Well, he seems to have dished poor old Bingo all right."
"That is the prevalent opinion, sir.
Brookfield tells me that down in the village at the Cow and Horses, 7-1 is being freely offered on Mr. Wingham and finding no takers.
Good Lord! Are they betting about it down in the village, too?
Yes, sir, and in adjoining hamlets also. The affair has caused widespread interest. I am told that there is a certain sporting reaction in even so distant a spot as Lower Bingley.
Well, I don't see what there is to do if Bingo is such a chump.
One is fighting a losing battle, I fear, sir, but I did venture to indicate to Mr. Little a course of action which might prove of advantage. I recommended him to busy himself with good works.
Good works?
About the village, sir. Reading to the bedridden, chatting with the sick, that sort of thing, sir. We can but trust that good results will ensue.
Yes, I suppose so, I said doubtfully. But by gosh, if I was a sick man, I'd hate to have a loony like young Bingo coming and gibbering at my bedside.
There is that aspect of the matter, sir, said Jeeves. I didn't hear a word from Bingo for a couple of weeks, and I took it after a while that he had found the going too hard and had chucked in the towel. And then, one night not long before Christmas, I came back to the flat pretty latish, having been out dancing at the embassy. I was fairly tired, having swung a practically non-stop shoe from shortly after dinner till 2 a.m., and bed seemed to be indicated. Judge of my chagrin and all that sort of thing, therefore, when tottering to my room and switching on the light, I observed the foul features of young Bingo all over the pillow. The blighter had appeared from nowhere and was in my bed, sleeping like an infant, with a sort of happy, dreamy smile on his map. A bit thick, I mean to say. We Woosters are all for the good old medieval hosp and all that, but when it comes to finding chappies collaring your bed, the thing becomes a trifle too moldy. I hove a shoe, and Bingo sat up, gurgling.
"'Smatter, smatter,' said young Bingo.
"'What the deuce are you doing in my bed?' I said.
"'Oh, hello, Bertie. So there you are.
Yes, here I am. What are you doing in my bed?'
"'I came up to town for the night on business.'
"'Yes, but what are you doing in my bed?'
"'Dash it all, Bertie,' said young Bingo querulously. "'Don't keep harping on your beastly bed. There's another made up in the spare room. I saw Jeeves make it up with my own eyes. I believe he meant it for me, but I knew what a perfect host you were, so I just turned in here.'
"'I say, Bertie, old man,' said Bingo, apparently fed up with the discussion about sleeping quarters, "'I see daylight.'
"'Well, it's getting on for 3 in the morning.
I was speaking figuratively, you ass. I meant that hope has begun to dawn. About Mary Burgess, you know. Sit down, and I'll tell you all about it.'
"'I won't. I'm going to sleep.'
"'To begin with,' said young Bingo, settling himself comfortably against the pillows and helping himself to a cigarette from my special private box, "'I must once again pay a marked tribute to good old Jeeves, a modern Solomon.' I was badly up against it when I came to him for advice, but he rolled up with a tip which has put me—I use the term advisedly and a conservative spirit—on velvet. He may have told you that he recommended me to win back the lost ground by busying myself with good works.
"'Bertie, old man,' said young Bingo earnestly, "'for the last 2 weeks I've been comforting the sick to such an extent that if I had a brother and you brought him to me on a sick bed at this moment, by Jove, old man, I'd heave a brick at him. However, though it took it out of me like the deuce, the scheme worked splendidly. She softened visibly before I'd been at it a week. Started to bow again when we met in the street and so forth. About a couple of days ago she distinctly smiled, in a sort of faint, saint-like kind of way, you know, when I ran into her outside the vicarage. And yesterday, I say, you remember that curate chap Wingham, fellow with a long nose?
Of course I remember him. Your rival.
Rival? Bingo raised his eyebrows.
Oh, well, I suppose you could have called him that at one time, though it sounds a little far-fetched.
Does it? I said, stung by the sickening complacency of the chump's manner.
Well, let me tell you that the last I heard was that at the Cow and Horses in Twing Village, and all over the place as far as Lower Bingley, they are offering 7-1 on the curate and finding no takers.
Bingo started violently and sprayed cigarette ash all over my bed.
"'Betting,' he goggled.
betting. You don't mean that they're betting on this holy, sacred... Oh, I say, dash it all, haven't people any sense of decency and reverence? Is nothing safe from their beastly, sordid graspingness?
I wonder, said young Bingo thoughtfully, if there's a chance of my getting any of that 7-to-1 money.
7-to-1? What a price! Who's offering it, do you know? Oh, well, I suppose it wouldn't do. No, I suppose it wouldn't be quite the thing.
You seem dashed confident, I said.
I'd always thought that Wingham...
Oh, I'm not worried about him, said Bingo. I was just going to tell you. Wingham's got the mumps and won't be out and about for weeks. And, jolly as that is in itself, it's not all. You see, he was producing the village school Christmas entertainment, and now I've taken over the job. I went to old Heppenstall last night and clinched the contract. Well, you see what that means. It means that I shall be absolutely the center of the village life and thought for 3 solid weeks, with a terrific triumph to wind up with. Everybody looking up to me and fawning on me, don't you see, and all that. It's bound to have a powerful effect on Mary's mind. It will show her that I'm capable of serious effort, that there is a solid foundation of worth in me. That mere butterfly as she may have once thought me, I am in reality, oh, all right, let it go. It's a big thing, you know, this Christmas entertainment. Old Heppenstall is very much wrapped up in it. Nibs from all over the countryside rolling up. The squire present, with family. A big chance for me, Bertie, my boy, and I mean to make the most of it. Of course, I'm handicapped a bit by not having been in on the thing from the start. Will you credit it that that uninspired donut of a curate wanted to give the public some rotten little fairy play out of a book for children published about 50 years ago, without one good laugh or the semblance of a gag in it? It's too late to alter the thing entirely, but at least I can jazz it up. I'm going to write them in something zippy to brighten the thing up a bit.
You can't write?
Well, when I say write, I mean pinch. That's why I've popped up to town. I've been to see that review cuddle up at the Palladium tonight. Full of good stuff. Of course, it's rather hard to get anything in the nature of a big spectacular effect in the Twing Village Hall, with no scenery to speak of and a chorus of practically imbecile kids of ages ranging from 9 to 14, but I think I see my way. Have you seen Cuddle Up?
Yes, twice.
Well, there's some good stuff in the first act, and I can lift practically all the numbers. Then there's that show at the Palace. I can see the matinee of that tomorrow before I leave. There's sure to be some decent bits in that.
Don't you worry about my not being able to write a hit. Leave it to me, laddie, leave it to me.
And now, my dear old chap, said young Bingo, snuggling down cozily, you mustn't keep me up talking all night. It's all right for you fellows who have nothing to do, but I'm a busy man. Good night, old thing. Close the door quietly after you and switch out the light. Breakfast about 10 tomorrow, I suppose, what? Righto. Good night.
For the next 3 weeks I didn't see Bingo. He became a sort of voice heard off, developing a habit of ringing me up on long distance and consulting me on various points arising at rehearsal, until the day when he got me out of bed at 8 in the morning to ask whether I thought Merry Christmas was a good title. I told him then that this nuisance must now cease, and after that he cheesed it and practically passed out of my life, till one afternoon, when I got back to the flat to dress for dinner, and found Jeeves inspecting a whacking big poster sort of thing, which he had draped over the back of an armchair.
"Good Lord, Jeeves," I said. I was feeling rather weak that day, and the thing shook me.
"What on earth's that?"
"Mr. Little sent it to me, sir, and desired me to bring it to your notice."
"Well, you've certainly done it."
I took another look at the object. There was no doubt about it, he caught the eye. It was about 7 feet long, and most of the lettering in about as bright red ink as I ever struck. This is how it ran. "Twing Village Hall, Friday, December 23rd, Richard Little presents a new and original review entitled What Ho, Twing? Book by Richard Little. Lyrics by Richard Little. Music by Richard Little. With the full Twing Juvenile Company and Chorus. Scenic effects by Richard Little. Produced by Richard Little."
"What do you make of it, Jeeves?" I said.
"I confess I am a little doubtful, sir.
I think Mr. Little would have done better to follow my advice and confine himself to good works about the village.
You think the things will be a frost?
I could not hazard a conjecture, sir, but my experience has been that what pleases the London public is not always so acceptable to the rural mind. The metropolitan touch sometimes proves a trifle too exotic for the provinces.
I suppose I ought to go down and see the dashed thing.
I think Mr. Little would be wounded were you not present, sir.
The village hall at Twing is a smallish building, smelling of apples. It was full when I turned up on the evening of the 23rd, for I had purposely timed myself to arrive not long before the kick-off. I had had experience of one or two of these binges, and didn't want to run any risk of coming early and finding myself shoved into a seat in one of the front rows, where I wouldn't be able to execute a quiet sneak into the open air halfway through the proceedings if the occasion seemed to demand it. I secured a nice strategic position near the door at the back of the hall. From where I stood, I had a good view of the audience. As always on these occasions, the first few rows were occupied by the Nibs, consisting of the squire, a fairly mauve old sportsman with white whiskers, his family, a platoon of local parsons, and perhaps a couple of dozen of prominent pew-holders. Then came a dense squash of what you might call the lower middle classes. And at the back, where I was, we came down with a jerk in the social scale, this end of the hall being given up almost entirely to a collection of frankly tough eggs, who had rolled up not so much for any love of the drama as because there was a free tea after the show. Take it for all in all, a representative gathering of Twing life and thought. The Nibs were whispering in a pleased manner to each other, the lower middles were sitting up very straight, as if they'd been bleached, and the tough eggs whiled away the time by cracking nuts and exchanging low rustic wheezes. The girl, Mary Burgess, was at the piano playing a waltz. Beside her stood the curate Wingham, apparently recovered. The temperature, I should think, was about 127. Somebody jabbed me heartily in the lower ribs, and I perceived the man Steggles. "Hello," he said. "I didn't know you were coming down." I didn't like the chap, but we Woosters can wear the mask. I beamed a bit. "Oh, yes," I said. "Bingo wanted me to roll up and see his show." "I hear he's giving us something pretty ambitious," said the man Steggles. "Big effects and all that sort of thing." "I believe so." "Of course, it means a lot to him, doesn't it? He's told you about the girl, of course." "Yes, and I hear you're laying 7-1 against him," I said, eyeing the blighter a trifle austerely. He didn't even quiver. "Just a little flutter to relieve the monotony of country life," he said. "But you've got the facts a bit wrong. It's down in the village that they're laying 7-1. I can do you better than that, if you feel in a speculative mood. How about a tenner at 100-8? "Good Lord! Are you giving that?" "Yes." "Somehow," said Steggles meditatively, "I have a sort of feeling, a kind of premonition, that something's going to go wrong tonight. You know what Little is. A bungler if ever there was one. Something tells me that this show of his is going to be a frost. And if it is, of course, I should think it would prejudice the girl against him pretty badly. His standing always was rather shaky." "Are you going to try and smash up the show?" I said sternly. "Me?" said Steggles. "Why, what could I do? Half a minute. I want to go and speak to a man." He buzzed off, leaving me distinctly disturbed. I could see from the fellow's eye that he was meditating some of his customary rough stuff, and I thought Bingo ought to be warned. But there wasn't time, and I couldn't get at him. Almost immediately after Steggles had left me, the curtain went up. Except as a prompter, Bingo wasn't much in evidence in the early part of the performance. The thing at the outset was merely one of those weird dramas which you dig out of books published around Christmas time and entitled 12 Little Plays for the Tots or something like that. The kids drooled on in the usual manner, the booming voice of Bingo ringing out from time to time behind the scenes when the fatheads forgot their lines, and the audience was settling down into the sort of torpor usual on these occasions, when the first of Bingo's interpolated bits occurred.
It was that number which what's-her-name sings in that review at the palace. You would recognize the tune if I hummed it, but I can never get hold of the dash thing. It always got 3 encores at the palace, and it went well now, even with a squeaky-voiced child jumping on and off the key like a chamois of the Alps leaping from crag to crag. Even the tough eggs liked it. At the end of the second refrain, the entire house was shouting for an encore, and the kid with the voice like a slate pencil took a deep breath and started to let it go once more. At this point, all the lights went out. I don't know when I've had anything so sudden and devastating happen to me before. They didn't flicker, they just went out. The hall was in complete darkness. Well, of course, that sort of broke the spell, as you might put it. People started to shout directions, and the tough eggs stamped their feet and settled down for a pleasant time. And, of course, young Bingo had to make an ass of himself. His voice suddenly shot at us out of the darkness. "Ladies and gentlemen, something has gone wrong with the lights!" The tough eggs were tickled by this bit of information straight from the stable. They took it up as a sort of battle cry. Then, after about 5 minutes, the lights went up again and the show was resumed. It took 10 minutes after that to get the audience back into its state of coma, but eventually they began to settle down, and everything was going nicely, when a small boy with a face like a turbot edged out in front of the curtain, which had been lowered after a pretty painful scene about a wishing ring or a fairy's curse or something of that sort, and started to sing that song of George Thingummy's out of Cuddle Up. You know the one I mean. Always listen to Mother, girls, it's called, and he gets the audience to join in and sing the refrain. Quite a ripish ballad, and one which I myself have frequently sung in my bath with not a little vim. But by no means, as anyone but a perfect sap-headed prune like young Bingo would have known, by no means the sort of thing for a children's Christmas entertainment in the old village hall. Right from the start of the first refrain, the bulk of the audience had begun to stiffen in their seats and fan themselves, and the Burgess girl at the piano was accompanying in a stunned, mechanical sort of way, while the curate at her side averted his gaze in a pained manner. The tough eggs, however, were all for it. At the end of the second refrain, the kids stopped and began to sidle towards the wings, upon which the following brief duologue took place. Young Bingo, voice heard off, ringing against the rafters, "Go on!" The kid, coyly, "I don't like to." Young Bingo, still louder, "Go on, you little blighter, or I'll slay you!" I suppose the kid thought it over swiftly and realized that Bingo, being in a position to get at him, had better be conciliated, whatever the harvest might be. For he shuffled down to the front, and having shut his eyes and giggled hysterically, said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I will now call upon the Squire Tressida to oblige by singing the refrain." You know, with the most charitable feelings towards him, there are moments when you can't help thinking that young Bingo ought to be in some sort of a home. I suppose, poor fish, he had pictured this as the big punch of the evening. He had imagined, I take it, that the squire would spring jovially to his feet, rip the song off his chest, and all would be gaiety and mirth. Well, what happened was simply that old Tressida, and mark you, I'm not blaming him, just sat where he was, swelling and turning a brighter purple every second. The lower middle classes remained in frozen silence, waiting for the roof to fall. The only section of the audience that really seemed to enjoy the idea was the tough eggs, who yelled with enthusiasm. It was jam for the tough eggs. And then the lights went out again. When they went up, some minutes later, they disclosed the squire marching stiffly out at the head of his family, fed up to the eyebrows. The Burgess girl at the piano with a pale, set look, and the curate gazing at her with something in his expression that seemed to suggest that, although all this was no doubt deplorable, he had spotted the silver lining. The show went on once more. There were great chunks of place for the tot's dialogue, and then the girl at the piano struck up the prelude to that Orange Girl number that's the big hit of the Palace Review. I took it that this was to be Bingo's smashing Act One finale. The entire company was on the stage, and a clutching hand had appeared round the edge of the curtain, ready to pull at the right moment. It looked like the finale, all right. It wasn't long before I realized that it was something more. It was the finish. I take it you know that orange number at the palace. It goes, "Oh, won't you, something, something, oranges, my something, oranges, my something, oranges. Oh, won't you, something, 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 I forget, something, 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 tumpty, tumpty, yet. Oh," or words to that effect. It's a dashed clever lyric, and the tune's good, too. But the thing that made the number was the business where the girls take oranges out of their baskets, you know, and toss them lightly to the audience. I don't know if you've ever noticed it, but it always seems to tickle an audience to bits when they get things thrown at them from the stage. Every time I've been to the palace, the customers have simply gone wild over this number. But at the palace, of course, the oranges are made of yellow wool, and the girls don't so much chuck them as drop them limply into the first and second rows. I began to gather that the business was going to be treated rather differently tonight when a dashed great chunk of pips and mildew sailed past my ear and burst on the wall behind me. Another landed with a squelch on the neck of one of the nibs in the third row, and then a third took me right on the tip of the nose, and I kind of lost interest in the proceedings for a while. When I had scrubbed my face and got my eye to stop watering for a moment, I saw that the evening's entertainment had begun to resemble one of Belfast's livelier nights. The air was thick with shrieks and fruit. The kids on the stage, with Bingo buzzing distractedly to and fro in their midst, were having the time of their lives. I suppose they realized that this couldn't go on forever and were making the most of their chances. The tough eggs had begun to pick up all the oranges that hadn't burst and were shooting them back, so that the audience got it both coming and going. In fact, take it all round, there was a certain amount of confusion. And just as things had begun to really hot up, out with the lights again. It seemed to me about my time for leaving, so I slid for the door. I was hardly outside when the audience began to stream out. They surged about me in twos and threes, and I've never seen a public body so dashed unanimous on any point. To a man and to a woman, they were cursing poor old Bingo. And there was a large and rapidly growing school of thought which held that the best thing to do would be to waylay him as he emerged and splash him about in the village pond a bit. There was such a dickens of a lot of these enthusiasts, and they looked so jolly determined, that it seemed to me that the only matey thing to do was to go behind and warn young Bingo to turn his coat collar up and breeze off snakily by some side exit. I went behind and found him sitting on a box in the wings, perspiring pretty freely and looking more or less like the spot marked with a cross where the accident happened. His hair was standing up and his ears were hanging down, and one harsh word would undoubtedly have made him burst into tears. "Bertie," he said hollowly as he saw me. "It was that blighter Steggles. I caught one of the kids before he could get away and got it all out of him. Steggles substituted real oranges for the balls of wool, which, with infinite sweat and at a cost of nearly a quid, I had specially prepared. Well, I will now proceed to tear him limb from limb. It'll be something to do." I hated to spoil his daydreams, but it had to be. "Good heavens, man," I said, "you haven't time for frivolous amusements now. You've got to get out, and quick." "Bertie," said Bingo in a dull voice, "she was here just now. She said it was all my fault and that she would never speak to me again. She said she had always suspected me of being a heartless practical joker, and now she knew. She said—oh, well, she ticked me off properly." "That's the least of your troubles," I said. It seemed impossible to rouse the poor Zib to a sense of his position. "Do you realize that about 200 of Twing's heftiest are waiting for you outside to chuck you into the pond?" "No, absolutely." For a moment the poor chap seemed crushed, but only for a moment. There has always been something of the good old English bulldog breed about Bingo. A strange sweet smile flickered for an instant over his face. "It's all right," he said. "I can sneak out through the cellar and climb over the wall at the back. They can't intimidate me." It couldn't have been more than a week later when Jeeves, after he had brought me my tea, gently steered me away from the sporting page of the Morning Post and directed my attention to an announcement in the Engagements and Marriages column. It was a brief statement that a marriage had been arranged and would shortly take place between the Honourable and Reverend Hubert Wingham, third son of the Right Honourable the Earl of Sturridge, and Mary, only daughter of the late Matthew Burgess of Weatherly Court, Hants. "Of course," I said, after I'd given it the east to west, "I expected this, Jeeves." "Yes, sir." "She would never forgive him what happened that night." "No, sir." "Well," I said, as I took a sip of the fragrant and steaming, "I don't suppose it will take old Bingo long to get over it. It's about the 111th time this sort of thing has happened to him. You're the man I'm sorry for." "Me, sir?" "Well, dash it all, you can't have forgotten what a deuce of a lot of trouble you took to bring the thing off for Bingo. It's too bad that all your work should have been wasted."
"Not entirely wasted, sir."
"Eh?" "It is true that my efforts to bring about the match between Mr. Little and the young lady were not successful, but still I look back upon the matter with a certain satisfaction."
"Because you did your best, you mean?"
"Not entirely, sir, though, of course, that thought also gives me pleasure. I was alluding more particularly to the fact that I found the affair financially remunerative."
"Financially remunerative? What do you mean?"
"When I learned that Mr. Steggles had interested himself in the contest, sir, I went shares with my friend Brookfield and bought the book which had been made on the issue by the Cow and Horses. It has proved a highly profitable investment." "Your breakfast will be ready almost immediately, sir. Kidneys on toast and mushrooms. I will bring it when you ring." End of chapter 15.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.